Good afternoon. It's March 7th, 2014, 2:16 p.m. Pacific Coast Time, North America. I'm located in Olympia, Washington, 47.22 north. Degrees latitude, definitely the rainy spot of the United States at the moment. We've just been come out of a very large rainstorm. We have a few minutes of a little bit of blue sky amidst chemtrails, but the numbers are quite staggering in terms of even of our normal rain. We had a drought until 2014, and then started catching up rapidly and exceeding things in January. Our February numbers, for instance, usually February being a short month, we get about 5.3 inches here in our little microclimate here in Olympia, Washington. And so this February we got 11.24 inches, so a little over twice. And then our March totals we've already exceeded in the first 7 days by an inch and a half. At one point there, the stuff was coming down at the rate of 1 1/3 inches per hour whenever we had the steady rain. And then some of the squalls would bring us what I imagine these lakes are like. It'd bring us rain coming down so fast that our rain gauge could not accurately measure it because of its the dynamics of how it was designed. It was overflowing faster than it could drain out and calculate. Not really good situation. And we've been quote dry in the sense of no active rain coming down for a number of hours since midnight last night, 1 o'clock, something like that. So a good 14 hours at this point. And we still have standing water everywhere. This is remarkable in our particular area because we live on a thin layer of topsoil soil that's over glacial fill, interspersed with clay in our local geology. So it drains rapidly. Once the water gets through this thin layer of topsoil, it just hits this gravel and it goes. Basically right out to Puget Sound. But there's so much coming through now that all those natural channels are full. We've got flooding everywhere. The rivers are running brown from all the sand and soil mixed in coming down out of the hills, and there's debris like mad out in the Sound, which brings up another issue. Watch out, boaters, if you're going to be out and about. This is going to be a general trend in the future, is more and more debris to run into. One of the reasons I engineered the bows on our proa the way I did, with this particular kind of a shoe and a sacrifice northwest prow kind of a thing, just in case we run into big trees at night or something along those lines. You can't really see them. I've done that, had this happen before. I mean, not every time, but let's say 2 out of 7 times that we go out, you end up running into something. Usually it's submerged, it's an old log, it's, half floating, mostly rotten, that kind of thing. Sometimes it's fresh wood, though. And occasionally, I was thinking of this really nasty incident about 18 or 20 years ago when we were out in the night, and beautiful starry night, but no moon. And the shore lights were up. There were no low shore lights, so we had no background illumination. Ran into a damn tree. It wasn't just any tree. There'd been a big storm like we have now. And the tree had washed down from I don't know where. It was old growth. And it had, probably 30-foot branches and maybe 25 and 30-foot roots sticking out of the root mass. I forget now which we impacted first. It wasn't my boat. I was out with this other guy in his boat, actually helping him bring it back. It had broken down, but in any event, we smacked into this big tree, probably 280 plus feet long. Old growth that washed down from somewhere. A lot of the bark was real pulpy, and it didn't hurt the fiberglass of the boat when we hit it, but then we got all entangled in the roots or the or the branches first. I say first because since we no sooner gotten loose from one, then the currents whipped us around and we went stern over stem right into the other and ended up spending like 5 hours trying to cut our way out of these. And you couldn't really see. We didn't know what the hell it was that had grabbed us at first. Took us some time to discover, oh, it's an old growth cedar, you know, a vast quantity of feeder roots sticking out and branches all to hell and gone. But that was not as bad as the time my dad hit a dead whale off of the Columbia bar in the middle of the night. That was probably 40 years ago. His stunk. Mine didn't. So there was no permanent damage to the boat. Anyway, though, I don't know why the hell I got off on that. Oh, yeah, the rain. The rain's been pretty good for us for the moment, simply because it's washing away all the radiation. We will have a high click count. One of these storms will come through, and we're good. It's clean. I mean, a very low click count. Anything that's like residual gets washed away in the main. I was very concerned there through October, November, and December, as we had an exceptionally dry period of time. And there was clearly a buildup of clickable material on the soils and the roof and this kind of a deal. Not a good situation with the Fukushima radiation. So we're quite pleased to see the rain. Looks like we're into a very definitive rainy pattern. This pattern is likely from our data sets to continue to oscillate, and it's part of the pattern that is producing these very large storms on the East Coast, and also the storms on the West Coast of Europe. It may indeed be part of a new pattern that may persist for a number of years, but we actually have some reason to think that this pattern will be disrupted or break sometime in August, maybe September of this year. Not that the pattern that will replace it will be any better for us in terms of how the impact on us individually from the climate. At that point, we expect a number of rather severe out-of-season storms. So, in other words, in some parts of the planet, the data is suggesting that in August, primarily in northern hemisphere, we'll get winter-like storms in the midst of what should be summer. And this will be very disconcerting for everybody, especially as it appears that we'll just sort of jump right over fall in some areas and go into this really nasty cold state. This is part of the oscillation into the ice age that we're going to experience. I don't know if this will persist. That's what we're waiting for, is the what we should call the day of persistence. And the day of persistence is when, or it'll be a month really, when it snows in say June, July, or August, and it doesn't melt, and there's no further melting of that, and by the time we roll around into the next summer, that persistence will have been the pattern, and it will have basically been snowy and start forming glaciers over the course of that year. Now, an interesting thing about a lot of these particular kinds of events, a lot of things in nature happen in a particular rhythm. The rhythm can be expanded, it can be stretched out, it can be compressed, and as you compress the frequency grows. And so just as with radio waves and so on. So in nature, what we get is we sometimes get these patterns, in fact, invariably, really, that it can be expressed from our viewpoint in distant history as being able to say that 11,000 years ago, an ice age began. And it took, 10,000 years for it to progress and mature. To the point where there was essentially no after effect. We've lived in that 1,000 years of the valley of this particular cycle, this unique warming period. Now, if we go back to the beginning of the Ice Age, from which we are now losing our neutrality, so to speak, and starting to go back into an ice age. Good. We don't want the go into a heat wave and end up like Venus. We need to get frozen again and purify the oceans and such. But 11,000 years ago, when the ice age, or 13,000, whatever number is, resonates with you, when that ice age began, it's safe to say that the seed or the beginning of that ice age can be traced back in the following kind of a statement about that pattern. That even though the whole pattern cycle, that whole from the top peak of the wave down to the bottom valley, bottom of the trough, was 1,000 years, and we call that, half cycle in an ice age, then, or excuse me, was 13,000 years, and we call that a half cycle in the, actually the Great Year, but also a half cycle in one of these little ice age patterns, then most of the activity of that ice age came about in the first year. 90% of all of the glacier building that later on accumulated to huge mass occurred within a single year, the beginning year. And of the seed material for the glacier, 90% of that occurred in a single month. And so really, it's a situation of where we can say that the ice age begins in, you know, the particular month of persistence. And that's this seed month where we get this snow that begins, continues for, you know, some period of time, and then stays, and it starts this chill effect. And from that point on, we get a glaciation in that particular area. We had such a thing occur at the time that the, you know, the guy they found frozen in the on the border between Italy and Switzerland, the caveman fellow. During his age, there was a glaciation period that began in South America. And that was when the seeds of many of the glaciers that are now disappearing were initially planted. And we can look from the ice cores on them that a lot of that activity that began that glacier all occurred within this more or less single lunar month, about 28 days. And from then on, it packs on and you get more and more and more. But it's not as though you you enter into an ice age where, for instance, you might think of it as, well, winter just becomes longer, and instead of getting into spring in March, maybe you have winter out until you know, May or so, and then a regular summer, and then the next year the winter gets out into a little bit into June, and then and you get regular summer from that point on. It doesn't work in that sort of a pattern. There's truly an oscillation between hot and cold, and then you get caught in one of the two cycles regionally. And there will be different examples of this all over the planet. Most of the northern hemisphere is for the ice age will get caught into the cold. Some areas of the southern hemisphere as well. There will be equatorial bands and tropical bands that will be stuck in sort of a heat vortex, the opposite, because there won't be the heat flow that normally goes to the poles that starts all this convection current kind of stuff. Instead, we'll see an outpouring of the fractured polar magnetic pole, which will cause numerous polar vortices to form. These may be widely scattered. There may be thousands of miles in separation between them. We may end up with a North Pole in northern Scotland and one in Canada and yet another in Siberia, all of which are sucking down vast areas of cold and creating their own miniature Arctic environment. The same thing may occur in the South Pole. And in some of these cases, these poles may fracture and be off by several thousands of miles from what we might think of as the as a usual resting place for these magnetic fields. And so that may be the bulge in Brazil, might end up being a cluster of south poles, and so we may end up with part of you know, now tropical regions suddenly becoming near Arctic or Antarctic conditions. This oscillation, this pattern, has been clearly evident developing since about the 1940s. Depending on how you look at the material, the science that we used to have, you can't trust anything coming out of government anymore. So all of our, if you're reading anything in terms of modern, last 10, 15 years, 30 maybe even, data sources out of government, you're going to be fooled into various different conclusions that are not accurate because all of these numbers are politicized and reported from a state's viewpoint, and you don't need that. You need to look at it from the planet's viewpoint. In any event, so here we are walking our way more or less certainly, although indeterminately, into this new ice age. We just don't know when it's going to occur, but it certainly will. We're also at the end of a 100,000-year cycle by 8,000 years, so we're 8,000 years overdue for one of these very long-term ice ages. Based on where our orbit is, you know, a presumed orbit on a heliocentric model. In any event, though, so we've got that. Now, We're getting yet more proof of expanding planet model here, which is part of our ice age and part of the fracturing of the magnetic poles. As the planet expands, by the way, you see that the internal magnet inside has also gone wonky, as all this plasma is pouring in from these high energy particles from the sun that go right through us, through the core, right into the core of the planet, where they get trapped in this plasma reaction, which is like one stage beyond a nuclear reactor in terms of intensity and so forth. And these high energy particles get trapped in there, they add more energy, it grows, it produces matter, makes the inner core grow, which ruptures the outer mantle, and we get all kinds of things from sinkholes, volcanoes, and so on. But at the same time, this growth pattern within the plasma, which is what generates our magnetic field, there is no ball of lead down there, or ball of iron rotating. It's a plasma source for the magnets. For the magnetic field, as the high energy particles come on roaring on in and the plasma gets disrupted, the magnetic field does as it is wont to do. It becomes unquiet, reduces itself as the planet expands, because everything's like separated, there's like areas of insulation and disruption that didn't used to exist. And it goes a little wonky, so it produces multiple north poles, multiple south poles, etc. These show up in our magnetic surface fields, and we experience them. They're generated by the plasma as a result of all of these things concurrently. And one of the things is that the planet itself is actually expanding from the input of new material way deep inside. We know this from any number of different metrics, but yet we've got another one, which is there's a big, huge crack in a dam along the Columbia River with all kinds of nasty noises coming out of it. And this crack is probably not a good thing. The dam is upstream of Hanford. If it lets go, Hanford is at risk. Hanford is a giant nuclear hellhole. That would wash all this nuclear hellhole down, theoretically, past Washougal and Portland. Portland would be a big jam-up for it. If there was any kind of debris to speak of, there's also downstream dams that would suffer. So it'd be a big, huge mess if this thing goes. We're not particularly in any risk here at the moment that I'm aware of from this, because we're so far north of the event that even if it becomes a plutonium radioactive nightmare from that point onward, we're still at a considerable distance, 120 miles north of the Columbia at that point. So I'm not personally at risk. Thanks for asking, guys. I've had a number of people inquire. But the whole region is at risk, and yet another pollution source for the Pacific would not be good in terms of this radioactive crap. So we should all hope that they figure out what the hell they're doing and fix this dam or drain it. Okay, so there was that. And let's see. Let's go back to oscillations real quick and some of our data and the silver and the gold and stuff. We have a chart that shows Bitcoin progress from way back when, maybe 2011, when it first topped over a dollar. And that chart was what I used that chart and shifted it about so it was accurate in its alignment with days and times in model space, such that the beginning of the chart aligned over model space as it should, and we had a projection that we would have Bitcoin prices at $3,405 when silver and gold were free of manipulation and began on their own to seek and discover price. And this was a period that's going to exist everywhere as we get into what we might call the grand price discovery as a result of the collapse of, or trashing of, or ignoring of, I don't know what the occurrence is, all government numbers relating to anything economic. Nobody believes it anymore. It's a subset of the hyperinflation stuff that goes on. So anyway, I had taken that chart and progressed it in the Bitcoin chart, measured it against model space, and it looked like we would come out with 3405 sometime in January through February. Now, what occurred was that we ended up with the Mt. Gox debacle, and we had yet another crash. All the Bitcoin crashes, by the way, can be put to Mt. Gox temporally, so they're probably causally related to Mt. Gox as well. But in any event, we had this Mt. Gox debacle with beginning, And so Bitcoin prices were just blown out of that particular pattern that we'd been using. Nonetheless, the linguistics showed that in the second week in January, we started picking up all these linguistics about the end of the Fed. And that was when the London Fixed became a known, talked about activity of all the big banksters, and it just goes on and on and on in terms of the amount of information coming out about gold and silver manipulation. So linguistically, it was accurate, which is to say the underlying model space. But when I did my matchup to the Bitcoin chart, I screwed it up. I wasn't prepared for the outlier, which was that Mt. Gox would come on in. Had Mt. Gox held steady in their previous pattern, we would probably hit something like 3405, about the time in February when that stuff, the linguistics, really took off. Now, we still have linguistic price descriptors that go to nearly the same number for Bitcoin. We don't have a date of occurrence, though. We have the period of time from which those descriptors are examined in the media. So in other words, I've got a numeral representation as text for a number over $3,000 referencing a price per Bitcoin in U.S. dollars that will show up in the more or less mainstream media as this particular occurrence is discussed. This appears to begin or show up in publication at some point in April. Now, because it was short-term data that holds this particular forecast, we have a three-week window in which that particular thing may or may not show up. I wish it should show up, and it may not. Our issue is there's also a three-week error rate in the short-term data. But in any event, the initial data sets would suggest that there's this discussion about a $3,000 Bitcoin price that will be in the media, and it should be here, let's just say, by the 21st or so of April, sometime in that time frame, April 20th, 420 or onward. And the initial time I plugged the chart against that, I'd already had that 3405, and when the chart was pressed against the model space from initial points of attachment, it appeared that it would come earlier in the year. So it was somewhat confusing. We still have this issue of a discussion of it, though, so the occurrence is probably on track, and it'll probably occur over the next 30-plus days as we get into this next little debacle, which brings us up into the silver and gold thing. Now, here's the thing about the silver and gold relative to what the data says. As the data was describing this period in which silver and gold become untethered from their manipulators, it's also, in essence, it also is explicitly describing the end of a period, which might be a week, it might be 2 weeks, maybe three. I really wouldn't think it would last 3 weeks, and two weeks might even be a stretch. But what causes the breakup of the manipulation scheme is a pressing of the objectives of the oppressors onto gold and silver in an extreme fashion as they are reacting to the events that occur and as the pressure on gold and silver exerts itself. Now, it's rather confusing, but basically here's what I'm describing. Describing a situation where the data suggests that there might be pressure upward on gold in the amount of, say, $15. And so in a particular day, it should rise $15. And so the powers that be freak out, and they push it down $16. The next time it rises, when they let up on the pressing, so to speak, the data shows that it will bounce back not only the $16 pressed down, but maybe an additional $3, $4, $5, or $6 on top of that. And so you'd get into a position where, all of a sudden, rather strikingly, gold went up $20-plus dollars in a day. And then they would push it down those $20-plus dollars and $1 or $2 more. And this pattern would repeat itself with the oscillations always increasing on the peak, or on the point towards increased price. And so they would be able to press it down, and they've got to really exert it, and they're trying each time to wipe out 100% of its gains up and then reduce it by a dollar. And I'm just picking this. It might be 22 cents or whatever. They've got some target there that they want to reduce it, all the gains plus this little tiny amount. The effect of all of this relative to the data set is that as it gets to a certain point here, and I can't speak to that at the moment. I'll get into that in a second. But we're going to get to a point here where it will press up on, gold pressure will put up, you know, $20, they'll push down 20, it'll go up 30, they'll push down 31, it'll go up 41, and all of a sudden the oscillations will start really gaining the attention of the investment market and then everybody else in short order, such that we see this period where we might get a $100 oscillation, $100 up in one day and $100 down in the same day, $101 down in the same day. And then the very next day, it'll go up, $105. And at the point that is described in the data, there's sort of like a hesitation because all of a sudden there's no push down. And so tentatively, it goes up another $10, and then tentatively another $30. And then by the end of the day, it might be up $200 or $300 or $400 or $500 by the time that we get to the end of that particular trading day within, and we're looking at New York and London markets, which I'm not sure in terms of time frame, but probably New York, but doesn't really matter. The impact is going to be, I know gold trades 24 hours a day. That isn't the impact, or that isn't the point. The point is that there will be a definitive market like New York market or London market, and I don't think it'll London, but in any event, in which we'll get this effect where there's just sort of like a little hesitation at the as they pass the previous day's peak, and then phew, off it goes with these little hesitations in between because everybody's waiting for the pushdown, and all of a sudden it doesn't come. And that'll also happen with silver. Within that same part of the data set, we have a language that indicates that I'm going to just be seriously under-characterizing the price of silver when I said it would go to $600 an ounce. So we have language suggesting silver at $1,000 an ounce. We have language suggesting silver at $1,200 an ounce. This is not necessarily in a market near you. Okay, so this is the issue here. As we get into this period of time, there's going to be all of this chaos going on, socially, politically, globally, and there will be chaotic markets everywhere. So the data is describing things where very much like previous centuries in which there were major social migration pattern changes in terms of people moving and nation states moving, like say the Franco-Prussian War. Some of these particular periods in which the populace was shifted around willy-nilly, there was a tendency for there to be a wide discrepancy between in commodity prices based on where you were locally, because there was effectively all inner empire communication was controlled by the military at that point, and it had been broken down relative to the civilian population. So you might ask for, you know, $1,200 an ounce for gold in your area simply because you're ignorant that it was going at, $5,000 an ounce 40 miles down the road. And that's the kind of situation we're going to end up with globally relative to markets in which one might expect to be able to buy or sell gold and silver. Okay, now there's the other component to this. At the same time that all this is going on, we have a chaotic global climate environment. A number of a large percentage of the population in denial of the impact on it, of this on their lives in the future, but a larger awakening population very much aware of this and starting to act very jittery. And so we get a situation in which the data is describing $1,200 an ounce for silver in one location and a third of that somewhere else, depending on local conditions. And also is reporting that we won't have anything close to the idea of a functioning market structure across the continents. So it means that, you know, you may have an effective market on the East Coast for gold and silver that's somehow separated electronically, physically, by weather or adverse conditions from central U.S. And that central U.S. market, again, might be separated by electronically, adverse conditions, who knows, from the Western market. So there might end up being three separate market bases, if you will, within the continental U.S. And those might even be further subdivided based on even more locally fracturing conditions as we go forward. So just because I say there's going to be $1,200 silver, do not rejoice, because it may be that that $1,200 silver price is 5,000 miles away from you, and you have no way of getting your silver there to take advantage of that price. So the situation is not cannot be construed as having anything close to our normal social infrastructure as we go on into these periods of the hyperinflation. The hyperinflation is going to change everything in and of itself. The just-in-time supply system is going to be negatively impacted by the global cost structures, the issues with obtaining oil, gas, etc., as well as the degrading climate environment and other man-made disasters that will result from the degrading climate environment. So in essence, we have a man-made disaster here with the dam happening in slow motion. If it breaks, you know, it causes a huge level of catastrophe and downstream damage. And if the dam hadn't existed, the issue would not exist. So it's not as though we're causing it, but we cause the conditions that result in the net effect. These things will also include nuke plants that are going to be negatively impacted by climate. So we have stuff in the data that suggests that rivers in the southeast may get so little rain at one point that the ability to pump water out of the rivers and cool nuclear reactors is jeopardized to the point where in some extreme cases convoys of water trucks are seen hauling ass to move water in there to cool the things. So it, you know, it gets rather challenging over these next few years. Okay, so that was the part about the silver and gold, the oscillation, the peaking on it. April is going to be the beginning of a lot of this stuff. There's also another temporal echo in late September that goes through late September and through October. That may be like the 29 crash, and this may be the 1928 crash, although really the crash we're going to get now, I think, replicates more 1914 and the economic pressures that began problems in that led to the War of 1812. I think we've got this echo going on in the early part of the centuries with century definitions. You know how the century is defined. So here's the thing about the silver and the gold prices relative to Bitcoin. At the moment, Bitcoin is like gold, but unsuppressed. They can't suppress the price. They're trying to suppress the mindset that deals with the price and everybody who might be attracted to it, but they can't really suppress Bitcoin itself. You know, you can't get in and cause the value to go lower or anything. Okay, so the impact of a lot of the social unrest that we're seeing, especially as regard to the brouhaha around Ukraine, is going to end up, insofar as our data is concerned from the previous run, is pointing to the beginning of this hyperinflation period, which is going to hit us in April. Now, we didn't know at the time we did the run with the data stretching back into October and November. This was to produce the report that was shipped out in January, that the hyperinflation would start as a result of a Ukraine invasion. We knew there were going to be shocks to the system. We knew that the Kabbalistic empire that controls Western, what we call Western civilization, would be getting huge shocks that would send it reeling and begin the hyperinflation. Now it appears that what will occur is the unleashing of an asymmetric financial war upon the U.S. as a result of the U.S. Basically bluffing against Russia, and Russia and China will start their asymmetric warfare and against the dollar, and that will induce a planetary dishoarding of the dollar, and that leads to the repatriation of the dollar to the U.S. That leads to the decision of the Federal Reserve later to try and cull digidollars. That is to say, they'll try and take it out as it comes in, but they end up screwing over a lot of people that will take it very badly. This is concurrent with a rise in the language that questions whether we need the Fed and its existence, whether it should be replaced, and so on. So that will occur, as I say, we'll have those things in place by the third week in April. They may start in on the first week in April, and may even begin this month in March, but they will be in place in all these elements by the third week in April, and that's when we can start looking for our hyperinflation. Now, you won't see $600 silver in a single day. You may see, you know, $400. You may see $100 silver, and then have it crash back to $20. The oscillations are going to be extremely severe as we go forward. It will be that the severity alone that will draw attention to it. They'll have to comment on it in the mainstream media, and that particular commenting is part of the temporal marker series that we're looking for particular actions to occur. When those actions occur, it basically means that the suppression of it fundamentally means that the suppression of gold and silver is gone, that they just can't do it anymore. And as I say, we get that period of time where it just goes up and then tentatively goes up much further and there's no pushback. And then the next period of time that market opens, you're looking at full-blown chaos. And, you know, politicians shitting bricks and, you know, sweating blood and their eyeballs bulging out, you know, their ears wanting to twist around on their own and all of this kind of thing. For the male politicians and the male banksters, you know, their penises are going to shrivel up and try and crawl back up inside them. It's going to be that severe. These guys are going to be that afraid of the consequences once this thing begins relative to the hyperinflation. And now I actually do suspect that the West will force Russia to do simply as Putin says, you know, react asymmetrically and take the dollar out. At the same time they do that, I expect a very large release of damaging information against all kinds of civil servants, celebrities in the U.S., and all, you know, like media celebrities and Hollywood guys and anybody with a certain level of profile and a certain cachet, if you will. Find that there'll be all kinds of legitimate, you know, honest but real dirt leaked out about them, and this will compound the situation relative to the politicians shitting brick and sweating blood and their eyeballs bulging out and their ears turning, because they'll be hamstrung by having to deal not only with a huge monetary crisis of which they have no concept nor of its scope nor its ramifications nor its nature, and at the same time that's going on, they'll be embroiled in their own individual horrors of all of their past dirty deeds coming out. So it's going to put things in a chaotic state that Sun Tzu would have been proud of. His art of war, you know, never attack your enemy the way where they're strongest. Look and see what really holds them. Where their nads are held, and then go for that. And we've got a situation where I think that's going to be done this year. Shortly, and it'll be at the level of the dollar, which of course, you know, is going to influence things like the price of Bitcoin and the price of gold and silver and everything, property and all this kind of stuff. I guess that's it. I've been doing a lot of sourdough baking. I've got to deal with a couple of sourdough loaves I've got here. Reason is I'm getting away from this recent experiment that we call commercial yeast. Turns out it's failed experiment. I think it's the yeast and the interaction with the wheat that causes the problem, GMOs aside, not the wheat itself. We were dealing with basically all different, this same strain of wheat or nearly the same strains of wheat for a number of generations prior to the introduction of commercial yeast. And we used sourdoughs for leavening, and they have an entirely different set of properties than commercial yeast do. The bread's better, etc. Anyway, for the palate, for the tongue, much more rich and varied and flavorful. But they release more minerals. They alter the nature of the proteins. They get rid of the phytase and other stomach annoying chemicals that wheat has. It's a If you want to think about it this way, the bees pre-digest with the introduction of beneficial bactofloras, the sugars, and we call it, and put them into a repository that we call honey. And so for us, honey is a pre-digested form of sugar, as yogurt is a pre-digested form of milk. And so sourdough breads are a pre-digested form of wheat. And it's probiotically digested. It's really good for you in any number of ways. Just go look up the nutritional component of it. But it's really tricky stuff to bake. You know, you have longer raise times, 10 and 12 hours. In the case of a 100% rye bread, if you're going to follow some of these Swiss recipes, it's incredibly light rye bread. I mean, it's the best damn rye bread on the planet, probably. I don't know of any others. Perhaps maybe some of these really cool Russian ryes. But anyway, the sourdough rye bread takes 2 weeks to raise. You know, it ferments for 2 weeks. So it's hugely digested, very light, very fluffy, not like your usual deli ryes. Anyway, though, the sourdough is intriguing. It's something we need to look at, especially in a high radiation environment. I think we need to get back to more sustaining and supportive kind of lifestyle elements and less of the commercial recent inventions, like, as I say, caked yeast or commercial yeast, which is a single strain. Anyway, so it's quite fascinating to deal with the sourdoughs and the many things, and you end up with all kinds of cool things to eat: sourdough breads, pancakes, etc. And it's, of course, quite sustainable, and you needn't involve yourself with the yeast. And then you get the health benefits out of it. And it may also, because of the nature of the components that come along with it, the minerals, the broken down kinds of proteins, and so on, there's some suggestion that sourdough may be slightly good for you if you're in a high radiation environment in other ways, in terms of helping to eliminate the radiation. But it's not like you can rely on sourdough bread to, you know, expunge the stuff from your system. It's just that, coincidentally, like oats, they have a tendency to help strip the colon of material and that kind of thing. So anyway, it's really good, and I've got to get a Vitamix chocolate pie down here real quick. And then all the other chores. We're about ready to begin our round square feet adventure here at Half Past Human. We have to relocate. There's just no question about it. Too many issues to go into, but this decision is irrevocable. We think we've found a chunk of property. It is like raw land, and I've got a whole lot of work involved there. But we're going to see if Kayla and I can't set up some cameras and capture some of this stuff as videos as we push forward with it. And the housing market is just hugely confused here in the Northwest. I'll go into the details some other times, but valuations from the county are all over the place because they don't know what's up and what's down. You know, if they listen to the federal government or the mainstream media, you've got recovery. But every single sale seems to be bringing in prices lower than the ones before. And so you don't have recovery. And so their taxation policies are just all over the map in terms of what the assessed value actually, what they think it is, which adds yet another element to this whole thing. Actually, this is not the time to buy property. If I had my druthers, as we used to say, a druther that we bought property later this year after the housing market fully crashes with the hyperinflation and the dollar going 100% bluey, we're just not in the luxury of being able to wait. We just don't have that capacity. So, you know, universe moves as it chooses. So I've got to deal with some people that think that their property really is worth that kind of money. they haven't encountered reality quite yet. So who knows how it's going to go there. But we've got everything staged. You know, we've got both yurts here. I ended up not selling that one because of the conditions that ended up existing here at the time. And Kathy's okay with the workload that's going to be forced on us and the austerity and all of the other conditions that we'll have to undergo to make this happen. And so we're bound and determined to go with the round square feet plan, the large deck. We're going to alter the deck to have, if we can get this chunk of property that I'm talking to some people about tomorrow. We'll alter the deck to include a hemispherical approach so that we have a better view. And it will be suitable for some of the other stuff that we want to do under the heading of 10X Labs. We'll set up a couple of webcams for naturists. And then we're going to set up some experiments that people can tune into, so to speak, as well as other fun stuff. Trying to figure out a way at the moment of funding a rather interesting proposal and project that has no benefit to anybody except for the very few people involved. And so I'm sort of noodling around on ideas with that. At the same time, it's a not a necessary precursor, but we'll be able to do some testing work if we do this project that would put us ahead when it comes to devising the molds for the hard yurt. We've got one of the molds done for the sides of the 30-foot Dungeness hard shell yurt, but we are ending up still having to engineer this very complex mold for the top piece. And I wanted to stop as long as we're relocating. We're not going to be able to continue with the mold work here until after all our yurts are set up and we've got them kitted out into houses and the garden planted and the domes moved and all of the other thousands of tasks necessary to get this to occur. I kind of want to add another one into it there with this particular kind of engineering for this constant camber pump system for production of basically hard shell yurt parts or boat parts or whatever. We'll see if we can't figure out a way to fund it, get a place to do it. One of the things we were thinking of doing was having some workshops where people interested in building their own material along this technology could come on down and we'd show them how it all worked and put them through the design process for how you build the molds, etc. Obviously later in the year, probably if we can get our shit together here, it'll probably be November. And that assumes that, you know, there's still enough social cohesion to allow meaningful travel and all of this sort of thing. Anyway, I got to get moving. Many chores, so we'll keep you informed as the round square feet thing gets moving. Oh, by the way, we're doing another report. Should be done maybe the end of this month. We have 31 days here. Maybe the end of this month. If not, certainly it'll be done in the first week of April. So you can look forward to that. We've had the data sets running here for the past couple of weeks. And some interesting wrinkles coming up. I haven't gotten into any of the interpretation stuff, so I haven't seen much of that. Well, okay, I guess that's it. Bye, y'all.